You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
When, as the New York Post headline suggested, President Ford told a nearly bankrupt New York City to drop dead in 1975, it was Felix Roatan, then the chairman of the Municipal Assistance Corporation, who's credited with pulling the city back from the brink of financial ruin. In his new book, Bold Endeavors, Mr. Roatan looks back at 10 major infrastructure projects paid for with federal money during earlier uncertain fiscal times and at possible solutions to the current national financial crisis. Mr. Roatan is a leading investment banker, a former senior partner at Lazard Frères. His book is published by Simon & Schuster, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Felix Roatan to this program today. Hello.
Well, I'm delighted to be here.
Does the current financial downturn bring back memories of the New York City crisis 30 years ago?
Well, yes, it does, because the people's reactions are quite similar. But there are great dissimilarities, and I think this particular financial crisis is much more dangerous.
In fact, you told the New York Times' Deborah Solomon that maybe for the first time in history, the U.S. is faced with doubts about its destiny. That sounds pretty serious.
Well, I think it is. I think the president is making a very great effort to deal with a recognition of the seriousness of the problem, and at the same time without telling people we're in the London blitzkrieg.
Well, do you think that he calmed any of your fears with his speech last Tuesday night?
Yes, I think he certainly didn't he didn't make them worse by any means, and he his tone, I think his approach is perfectly sound, but it's very complicated, and the problems are very complicated. The interests are not at all parallel, and the solutions are not evident.
So, what you learned from helping solve the city's fiscal crisis 30 years ago really is not applicable to this crisis?
It is applicable, because I think what we did, rightly or wrongly, and certainly we had a lot of help. I just want to make that point. We had a great governor. We had labor leaders whom we could work with. We had banks. We still had New York banks at that time that could work with us.
That weren't all falling apart.
Yes. We had newspapers who were very supportive. The Daily News was hugely supportive. It was the Daily News who embarrassed President Ford.
Oh, it was the News, not the Post.
To run that headline. And we had kind of a war where we were fighting against the rest of the country, which was trying to put us out of business. And that elevates things. Here we have a much greater element of size, just pure size of the problems we're dealing with, and we get squashed under these numbers.
Well, do you think that the country is blaming New York because of Wall Street's role in this crisis?
No, I don't think the country is blaming New York as much as it did at the time of the New York crisis, when it was purely look at liberals bankrupting themselves.
Did infrastructure spending play much of a role in New York City's recovery from its crisis in the 1970s?
Well, we were able to, when we restructured the finances of the city, at a time when all capital spending was stopped, we did bring it back up to the $5, $6, $7 billion, I forget what the numbers were, of the pre-crisis financing. And I think we have since that time, the mayor, the governor, have committed large sums of money to capital spending for the city.
The natural inclination is to cut back on spending when there's a financial crunch. Is that counterintuitive?
Well, to the extent that it's cutting back on capital spending, it is counterproductive. What presumably one should do if things get tighter is to cut down on daily expenditures, on your total budget deficit, and try to keep the capital spending as much as possible on schedule so that you don't get these penalties for late and so that the project can continue and without depreciating the asset that you're trying to build.
My guest is Felix Roatan, who's written a book called Bold Endeavors, How Our Government Built America and Why It Must Rebuild Now. It is published by Simon & Schuster. You've called for the federal government to create a national infrastructure bank to finance major infrastructure improvements. Didn't Barack Obama propose something similar during his presidential campaign?
I think so. And I think he may have been talking about what we've been talking about.
Had you any input in that?
No.
Would the U.S. National Infrastructure Bank be modeled after the European Investment Bank, which has financed Europe's railroads, among other projects?
Yes, and also to some extent the World Bank.
But there has been a bill for something like this before Congress, I think, since 2007.
Well, Senator Dodd, Chris Dodd, and Chuck Hagel put in a bill.
And Chuck Hagel is no longer in Congress.
Unfortunately, but we didn't put him out. In fact, we would have dearly hoped that he would stay. He's a wonderful man.
What happened to the bill?
The bill is in the committee, in the banking committee.
So for 2 years it's been sitting there? What's taking so long to be decided upon?
I think it isn't such an easy thing to pass for everybody. And at that time, of course, but most of the time the Democrats didn't have a majority. So they were not in a position to push this as hard as I think they can now.
Well, how would the creation of a national infrastructure bank change the way infrastructure is built in this country?
Because presumably the bank, the board of the bank, the staff of the bank would all be trained and aimed at making the best possible proposal among the differing proposals that would be made to the bank. And because the bank, all federal and other proposals would have to come to the bank in order to get a sense of what the best thing is.
So this would eliminate things like the Alaskan Bridge to Nowhere.
Yes, and it would eliminate the cheating that goes on here, yes.
And I would think that since people are talking about eliminating all of that in the way that we write legislation these days, that this would be popular with everybody in Congress.
I think that you're smiling as you say that. I can.
Well, would the creation of a national bank make it easier to prioritize projects according to need or their anticipated economic benefit?
Oh, of course it would be. It would be able to do that. It would be able to make some contiguous states work with each other on a regional basis, which we don't have at all at this point.
And how would it be financed?
Well, it would be financed first by the sale of bonds by the bank itself.
That's even if Wall Street is slow to recover?
Yes, because they're what is presently set aside as capital for the bank and for infrastructure is about $70 billion a year. And if that became the capital of the bank and you could leverage it and sell bonds based on that revenue stream, you would have $300-400 billion a year that rapidly could be put to use on more infrastructure. Now, the civil engineers have come out with a statement that $2.2 trillion is needed to bring the infrastructure on a normal basis to build over 5 years. Now that's a great deal of money, but if we have a bank that can produce $300-400 billion a year, both in terms of its own capital and in terms of the bonds that it can sell, then you begin to have something that you can work with and make a lot of progress.
Well, some people have criticized the $787 billion economic stimulus package that President Obama signed into law last week because it doesn't allocate as much money for infrastructure projects as many of them had hoped. But the cutbacks were because of concerns of spending too much money.
I don't know what the cutbacks were subject to because we believed that there would be more infrastructure spending than finally was the case with the stimulus, which which turned out to be about $100 billion.
Would you have preferred fewer tax cuts and more infrastructure spending?
Oh, absolutely, without a question of a doubt.
Now, it is argued that that would have given us more bang for our bucks, and yet Congress made this adjustment. Why do you think that is?
Well, would you suggest that it might be selfishness or poor judgment or the Republican versus Democrat? Also, there was a shift in, I believe, in some of the positions of some of the Democrats to give more weight to social programs than to infrastructure.
You have made 10 infrastructure proposals here, long-term ones, in this book. Has the perceived need for the government to pump money into the economy as quickly as possible made it more difficult to consider the creation of these sorts of things? Everybody's talking shovel ready these days.
Well, I don't think you know, whether we build something in 6 months or a year or two doesn't make that much difference. But we haven't suggested the particular programs. What I have done is written about 10 particular events that I thought were good examples of the federal government stepping in to help the private sector.
In the past. But today, you can't imagine some of these things ever going through.
Well, it depends. I think the country is ready to be led to that kind of outcome. I think people are rather tired of seeing their money wasted and turned into simply a little more money for a lobbyist.
Well, is it more difficult for politicians and the public to envision the positive economic impact of repairing bridges and schools than it was for them to imagine the benefits of a highway or a railroad that would connect the East and West Coasts?
Well, I think you need to do both. You need to repair what is out of what isn't working. And that's probably the best saving. I mean, the quickest way to save money is to repair what's decrepit, to recover things, but on a parallel basis, to start new projects. And I mean, it's hard to imagine something that could approach the difficulty of building the Transcontinental Railroad and running 19th century trains over 10,000 foot peaks. But they did manage to make it happen.
Although you have repeatedly claimed that you're an economist and not a historian, this is his history, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, but it's thrilling history. I mean,
so you're becoming a new – is this a new career path at the age of 80?
Well, I hope so, because I won't be able to do much else after the age of 80.
Well, how did you decide which projects to include here? They range from the Louisiana Purchase – and the Erie Canal to the GI Bill and the construction of the interstate highway system.
Because I wanted to essentially look at it at sort of a stepping stone picture of the government's role, which was different from case to case, as the century came to the 20th century. And with for very different goals. I mean, whether it was education, whether it was transportation, whether it was the Panama Canal, whether it was the intellectual capital that was created by the acts of education, and mostly by the GI Bill, which to me is the greatest thing that this country has ever done.
Didn't most of these projects face a fair amount of opposition?
Oh, tremendous. Partly for political grounds, partly because people were trying to gauge some money out of the system. And a lot of people died. I mean, there were 40,000 Chinese, I think, that died. Because it was so hard to work on these peaks.
My guest is Felix Roatan, who was a managing director at the investment banking firm Lazard Frères and Company, served as U.S. ambassador to France. From 1975 to 1993, was chairman of the Municipal Assistance Corporation of the State of New York. We managed the negotiations that enabled New York City to resolve its financial crisis. And he's written a book called Bold Endeavors, How Our Government Built America and Why It Must Rebuild Now, published by Simon & Schuster. We'll be back with more right after this. We're back with Felix Roatan, who's written a book called Bold Endeavors, How Our Government Built America and Why It Must Rebuild Now. It's published by Simon & Schuster. I was struck, Mr. Roatan, by how much these 10 projects that you write about here had in common, although they were undertaken at very different times. One of the things that they seem to have had in common is that they had a single committed champion who was prepared to fight on for years.
Absolutely. And real ups and downs. I mean, you look on the Erie Canal and what DeWitt Clinton went through for, I don't know, 10, 15 years.
Abraham Lincoln was the force behind the construction of a transcontinental railroad system.
Right, because he was a great labor lawyer before he became president, and he was a big fan of railroads and connecting the East and West from a political point of view.
And then there's Warren Atherton, who was the head of the American Legion, who pushed the GI Bill at the end of World War II.
Well, I think to me the GI Bill is still the model of what citizenship should be, because I mean here was a country thanking its veterans by providing them both with higher education and with shelter and with housing, and most people forget that the GI Bill of Rights involved veterans getting free half the cost of their house.
And today, with the way veterans are being treated, you have to wonder why we haven't learned a lesson from the GI Bill.
Yeah, and when we see how mortgages are being treated.
You tell a moving story here about your own experience at Middlebury College in 1946, living in a fraternity house with two vets who were attending school on the GI Bill.
Yes, and we had the visit of a senior officer of a big telephone company, who came to tell us that we were wonderful people, but we couldn't stay in the house because we were not acceptable. There were two of us who were not acceptable, one young African-American and another, the Jewish man who is sitting here. And I thought, it's over again. We just made it out of occupied France and South America and North Africa, and I thought, I've just landed a place where I'm going to be able to spend the rest of my life, and I'm just about thrown out for the same reasons that I was chased out of occupied France. And these two guys got up and stood on each side of this gentleman and actually carried him out the door and took him to the railroad station. That was a great moment in my life.
The historian Stephen Ambrose once wrote, the GI Bill was the best piece of legislation ever passed by the U.S. Congress. It made modern America. Do you imagine that the creators of the GI Bill had any idea that the infusion of capital for education and housing would change the country as much as it did?
No, actually, the establishment of higher education was bitterly against this. The president of Harvard, the president of the University of Chicago were very much against it.
Because it would lower their standards?
Yes,
would make them less elite?
Yeah, and one of them said, you're going to have a hobo jungle of education. And they had the greatest success. I mean, the graduating classes and the performance of the veterans was extraordinary. And in addition, we had a housing boom as a result of the fact that the bill provided for housing. And I still remember what and you could image in those years in 46, 47, 48, you knew whether somebody had been in the service simply by the way they walked, etc. And the impact of these veterans coming to Middlebury College, a small college in the woods of Vermont. And these guys were still there, their patches, their military patches on their shirts. It was quite a moment.
You've included a section on FDR's effort to bring electricity to people living outside of major cities. Didn't he discover firsthand a decade before he was elected president how badly most rural customers were being served by the electric industry? He moved to Georgia in 1924 to be treated for polio, and that's when he found out about it?
Yes, when he had rented and he happened to look at a bill, at an electricity bill, which was twice or three or four times what he was paying when in New Hyde Park up north for a great deal less.
So they were charging rural customers more than, if they even made it available, then they were charging urban residents.
Absolutely. And when FDR and the people he, and Tommy Corcoran, the people he had involved in the process of getting electricity to the rural parts of this country, saw how they were being abused and rollered by the big utility companies, he pushed and pulled and finally got this thing done.
Well, the utility company said it would be prohibitively expensive to electrify the whole country.
$2,000 a mile, I think they said, and it turned out to be $1,000.
And then in 1935, FDR created the Rural Electrification Administration. And the federal government could afford even that $1,000 a mile that maybe some of the companies couldn't.
But another great, I think, product of this age was the RFC, was the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which was created by Herbert Hoover, as a matter of fact, towards the end of, after the end of World War I and just as the Depression was starting. And the RFC was first used by Roosevelt to first close the banks and then reopen them and finance them, and later on to finance the war effort. I mean, a lot of the airplane production, converted automobile production, chemicals, et cetera, were run by the RFC.
Well, right now, one of the objections we're hearing to some of the proposals in Washington is that they are socialism. Aren't these, and you're talking about Herbert Hoover, in fact, aren't these kind of socialism, whether we called it socialism or not?
Well, you know, now we're talking about whether the government should take over the banks here. And the argument against it is that it's socialism. I was in France in 1982, when a socialist government was elected in France, and they automatically nationalized the big companies and the banks. And people yelled and screamed, but still Mitterrand put it through. And they fixed up. One of the reasons they were doing this was to fix them up. And over a 4 or 5 year period, they were actually successful. And they put these companies back on the market, and they were actually better, most of them, from what it was before. So I'm not saying one should nationalize companies just for the exercise. But it's oversimplifying to say that this is all socialism.
Well, we see the impact on American life of the electrification of the rural areas, which, by the way, wasn't completed until the 50s, because it created jobs, it increased prosperity, narrowed the cultural divide between the cities and the farms.
That's right. Well, infrastructure as a whole, as an asset class, if you will, is one of the most job-producing activities that you can create. So you create employment, you create income, you create improved standard of life, you include greater productivity. And I've never quite understood why there was all this opposition to it, because it's government, and, you know, government does... The reason I tried to write this book was to be able to say, you see, government has done good things. Doesn't mean all of them, but I think all the ones I picked turned out to be good things. They had problems.
And we'll get into some of those
problems.
But I wonder whether you think that there are any lessons in FDR's rural electrification project for the current effort to provide all areas of the country with broadband access.
Oh, absolutely.
Would that have a similar effect on the economy, do you think?
I can't say that because I'm pretty ignorant of high technology. But it's progress, and of course it would do good things.
My guest is Felix Roatan. His book, Bold Endeavors, How Our Government Built America and Why It Must Rebuild Now, is published by Simon & Schuster. And as we said earlier, all of the initiatives that you've written about here face huge opposition at the time that they were conceived. Wasn't the construction of the Erie Canal, which was completed in 1825, seen by many, including Thomas Jefferson, as a project that was unfeasible and ahead of its time?
Oh, yes. And DeWitt Clinton mostly stuck to his guns and got people working on this and got the people involved by distributing leaflets and showing what would happen and what would happen to the economy of New York State and New York City once you had this canal. And it turned out to be brilliantly successful.
And as you pointed out, the GI Bill was opposed by some people, including segregationists, who saw it as something that would give benefits to black soldiers.
Well, the GI Bill almost lost in Congress by one vote. Because a senator from Georgia was absent for the vote, and he had left his vote with Senator Rankin, who was a racist from Mississippi. And in order to let him vote, because this particular senator was not going to be there, and Rankin refused to vote. So there was clearly a situation where there wouldn't be a majority, and the thing would go down. And they sent planes down to Georgia. They sent police cars. And finally, this senator came in at 10 o'clock in the morning when they were about to vote and not only voted for the bill, but reminded them that 6 hours earlier, the troops had landed in Normandy and kids were dying.
Several of the projects you've written about, including the Panama Canal and the Transcontinental Railroad, had flaws. You mentioned a lot of people died. There was also a lot of corruption, wasn't there? And isn't that a concern today?
Of course. But, you know, just because something is risky or something has problems doesn't mean you walk away from it. The people who started building the Transcontinental Rail were crooks. Leland Stanford, Huntington. I mean, they were out-and-out crooks, and they created a company to actually buy the equipment for the railroad, and they just swiped all of the profits. But that doesn't mean you don't build the railroad. That means you build the railroad and take actions that protect you.
Go ahead.
No, and the same for the Panama Canal.
In the case of the railroad, Chinese workers were allowed into the country to do the dangerous construction work. Many died.
Yeah.
And then after it was over, we enacted all sorts of restrictive immigration laws to keep more Chinese from coming in.
Yeah, and we also killed a lot of Native Americans.
Because we were displacing them to build them.
That's right. And that's why there were so many raids by tribes who were just trying to save their land and themselves.
So here we are. You're saying we should have some kind of a cohesive plan. Up until now, basically, these things were done through earmarks, and some earmarks actually were good and benefited people, and other earmarks get a lot of attention because they are ridiculous and they're just ways of bringing some pork home.
That's right.
How do we prevent this from being pork, even if we have some kind of overriding organization that is setting this up?
Well, clearly, one of the reasons for setting up this structure, this bank, is in addition to oversight on building the project, it's also protecting the taxpayer from getting abused. But that's a question of security and how you police yourself and how you overlook, you know. It's not impossible.
What would you like to see now? Many people are talking about a high-speed railroad of the sort that you see in Europe, but that we have not had in this country.
Of course, I think high-speed rail is one of the absolute priorities.
Because it would be good for the environment as well.
It'd be good for the environment. It would take some of the pressure off of air travel, because if you can take a train and it goes at 250 miles an hour, you can get to places fast, and city to and door to door, and you would take a lot of congestion off the airline system, and it's a wonderful, comfortable way to travel.
I've done it in Europe, and the other nice part of it is that you go from a convenient place to another convenient place instead of to an airport that has to be pretty far away from the city.
Absolutely. The when we were in Paris, the French opened a line, a high-speed line from Paris to Lyon.
Mm-hmm. I've been on that, the TGV.
That's right. And the time in transit was cut by a third or something like that. And from the next day, the airline congestion was down. And it is a pleasure to step into a train that you don't even feel is moving downtown somewhere and getting off at the other end, again, downtown.
What are some of the other things that you would like to see? Have you thought this through?
I would like to see, I mean, I'm driven a lot, you know, in terms of my experience memory, if you will, outside of my business, was essentially Mac and the city. And it dealt with how to deal with the problem, how to deal with the people. But I never got to the point where I wanted to run anything other than Mac, which was a creator. We used the power of Mac, the power to create money to build, but nothing more.
Well, right now, one of the major building projects in New York City has been cut back considerably. The whole area around the World Trade Center,
yes,
and the transit hub, because there isn't enough money. There are other people who suggest that we shouldn't even be thinking about building new things. There is such a need to repair the things we already have. Every one of our bridges, mm-hmm, needs serious repair. The highways, I mean,
yes,
driving on New York City streets sometimes can be an incredibly bumpy experience.
Well, any serious infrastructure movement in this country would be heavily leaned at the beginning on repairs and reworking, because that's the thing you can do more quickly, and that's the thing that gives you the biggest bang for the buck initially.
Weren't concessions from the unions a big part of saving New York City in the 70s? Do you think you'll need to see the same sort of concessions from unions to affect some change today? We're talking about the car industry, for example, but also municipal government. The unions have been pretty damaged as it is by now, haven't they?
The what?
The unions are in serious trouble as it is
right now,
and many have given a lot of concessions.
Oh, yes, the industrial unions have given a great many concessions. The municipal unions, when we worked with them in 75-76, we negotiated significant concessions, both in terms of pay, in terms of pensions, et cetera. But we also saved the unions, because if the city had gone bankrupt, the unions would have lost their pension funds, because they were way underfunded. And so there would have been not only layoffs, but there would have been bankrupt pension funds. And they knew that, and we worked with them. And actually, at the end of the day, the unions came out on top. They made money. All of their deferrals were paid back. Most of them then were hired back. And I think for the city, it was a great success.
Well, do you think that's likely today, when many people are upset by the high cost of pension plans, even though workers will tell you, well, one of the reasons I took a low-paying job was because I was guaranteed a pension somewhere down the line?
Well, I think if you have a problem like that, it sounds sort of hokey what I'm about to say, but you sit down and talk about it. Not because everybody's going to melt away, but first you have to get the facts. And once you have the facts, you begin to see if there is a solution that might be acceptable to both sides. That's what we did with the city, with Victor Gottbaum.
We didn't have a GI Bill after the Vietnam War, and it's unlikely that we'll have one now as a result of the Iraq War. Is it because these are wars that we're more ambivalent about?
I don't know, but I think there was a GI Bill that took you. I was in the Army during the Korean War, and I believe I was covered by the GI Bill. I think it went to that point. I don't know about Iraq.
Mm-hmm. Would you like to see it?
Would you like to see a GI Bill?
Do you think in this environment that it would even be possible to convince Congress to pass something like that?
Well, I don't know why. I mean, a kid going to Iraq and getting shot at, he's as good a candidate to be given free college, I think, than if he'd been in Korea or if he'd been somewhere else. Yes, I would support that.
Well, do you know whether anybody in Congress is reading your book? Have you sent it off?
I would hope we were sending him off today.
The book is Bold Endeavors, How Our Government Built America and Why It Must Rebuild Now. It's published by Simon & Schuster, and it has been my great pleasure to speak with Felix Rohatyn today.
Well, pleasure was mine, sir.